Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So you in the audience here at the museum and also on the web, you're not a random audience. We've asked you all to join us because you all are crucial players in our democracy. You all are crucial to the status of our civil society, and I just wanted to thank you so much for the work you're doing and encourage you to reach out to one another over the course of the day and virtually to engage in this conversation, because I think you all will be much richer for it, and I think our state and our nation will be richer for it as well. The Searching for Democracy Initiative, today is the kickoff, and it will lead into the national election in 2012. There are a number of great programs that we have going, including a statewide read of four books that we'll tell you about in the spring, this spring, and the books will be read and discussed from spring 2012 into the national election. This is going to be a great program with just exciting programs throughout the state, and we're looking forward to it. I wanted to thank our funders, the National Endowment for the Humanities. I wanted to thank the State Library. And the state librarian is here, Stacy Aldrich. Could you raise your hand? Thank you for your support and partnership and your leadership. I also wanted to thank the Seedling Foundation, the Bay Tree Fund, and I also wanted to thank Scott Schaefer and KQED Public Media. I've been a long admirer of Scott's work and his contributions to knowledge about California, and just so excited to have you all as partners. Thank you. We have an exciting day ahead. Some of the smartest thinkers about the state of our democracy, the history of our democracy in the world. So we're going to have some just great conversations. Afterwards, for those of you who are here today, I invite you to join us for a reception, and virtually we'll toast you, all of you online. So thanks very much. I'll hand it over to Scott.
Thank you, Ralph. I just want to let you know, folks, that before we started, I mentioned to each of our panelists that I want them to think about this as kind of a dinner party where just interesting conversation happens and that people don't necessarily wait to be called on, but that everyone be spontaneous. And I wanted to tell you that in case they're talking over each other at some point animatedly. I don't want you to think that they're being rude. They're doing what I asked them to do. So at this opening session, we're going to lay out a framework and hopefully a context to discuss our history, our present, and a possible future for civic engagement in our country. How do we improve or change our political discourse so that it includes more voices and leads to a more fully engaged nation? Or do we have to change it at all? Are things working just fine? It's a big topic to cover, and I think we've got just the panel to do it. Let me tell you who's here with us, and I'll ask that you please hold your applause until we're done. Starting on the end there, Joyce Appleby is a distinguished professor emeritus at UCLA, where she taught history for 20 years. And among her interests, analyzing social theories about human nature, politics, and economic development, her latest publication is titled The Relentless Revolution, A History of Capitalism. Next to her, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, probably well known to viewers and listeners of PBS and NPR as a regular analyst of political campaigns and communication. She directs the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania and is the author or co-author of 15 books, including most recently, The Obama Victory, How Media, Money, and Messages Shaped the 2008 Campaign. Next to her is Gregory Rodriguez. He's founder and executive director of Zocalo Public Square, which connects people to ideas around the world in a nonpartisan way and over a wide range of fields, from politics to humanities to technology. He's also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, where he writes on topics including race relations, civic engagement, and immigration. And finally, to my right, Ron Nearing. He's been involved in politics since his days as president of his college Republican Club almost 20 years ago. Today, he's chairman of the California Republican Party, a role he inherited a couple of years ago when the party was deep in debt. Since then, he's led the party back into the black, directing large-scale voter registration drives along the way while emphasizing outreach to minority voters. Please welcome all of our panelists. All right, let's get started. Kathleen Jamieson, let me begin with you. What drives civic engagement, do you think? What determines whether or not someone is going to get involved in some way or another in our civic discourse today?
perceived salience of an issue to your lives. And perceived is the operative word, because you can be persuaded that things are relevant to you that may not be as central as other things. And so a real concern in a public dialogue is, are we talking about the things that are the most consequential in a way that lets us address them sensibly, not only in the short term and the long term? And different people will answer the question differently. I'm from Pennsylvania. Right now, an issue in Pennsylvania that may not be an issue for the people in this audience is hydrofracking. How are we going to get natural gas out of Pennsylvania, major supply in my state, without endangering the water supply and causing a toxic chain reaction that has real consequences in the lives of Pennsylvanians? We need to solve the energy crisis. A lot of concern about how to do it in Pennsylvania. How can we do this responsibly? Should we do it? Is it in the best interest of the nation in Pennsylvania to do it? If so, how?
So you're saying just very, in a very personal, in many cases, a local issue that's at stake. It has to really involve them in a personal way.
Well, at the national level right now, we're all involved in a common dialogue as we try to make decisions about how to balance the budget, how to make the trade-offs that ultimately will be fiscally responsible in the long term. In an environment in which, in most campaigns, we are told there's a free lunch, that things don't cost anything and we can kick those costs down the road if they exist. In most campaigns, we're told there are no trade-offs, when in fact they are. In governance, both of those things are real. Roosters and chickens all coming home to roost now. This is a time in which the nation's focused on those questions. How we debate them will determine whether or not the nation addresses these things in a way that's responsible in the long term.
Ron Ehring, do you agree with that, that politics and government engage people in different ways, and should they?
Well, I want to agree completely that I think that perceived self-interest is a major motivator. And when people are concerned about their future or their children's future, they're more likely to become engaged in a particular issue. I think that that was the case in the 2008 campaign with many people who engaged on both sides of the aisle. Barack Obama tapped a whole group of people who were not previously politically engaged. I think that's also true of the Tea Party movement in 2009, 2010, that when people feel as though there are events taking place around them which have a direct impact on their future, that they're more likely to be engaged. I think emotion drives behavior. We know that. The French Revolution, the revolution in Egypt, the American Revolution didn't happen because people were thrilled. They happened because people were upset and they wanted to have a change there. In fact, I teach campaign school around the country and around the world, and I'm constantly stressing to candidates that when you talk about an issue, you have to make it relevant to the audience that you're talking to. Don't talk in terms of trillions and billions and numbers that people, that are so abstract that no one can identify with. Talk about how your issue has an impact on the daily lives of the people you're talking to.
Kathleen Jameson was implying that the campaigns, all kinds of campaigns, manipulate people, though, into getting upset, getting riled up, and sometimes rounding off the differences or making the choices that are really on the table kind of go away and get them to focus on something that's maybe not quite as accurate as the facts would lead you to believe.
Well, like I said, emotion drives behavior, and there's a need to tap into that, particularly when you're looking to drive people to act. You're looking to encourage people or that they feel a need to vote, they feel a need to get involved, feel a need to donate their money or their time. And so very often you find political rhetoric is very often emotionally laced. And that's nothing new, that's nothing unusual, but you're tapping into that because unless people are emotional about something, not necessarily in a negative way, in a positive way too, hope, for example, that they may not be as prone to act. So as we candidates and political parties are always seeking to engage people, to get people to engage on their side, and emotion is a big component of that.
But I think we should see that we're now at a time when there's a great deal of indignation and there's spontaneity in people's responses. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you're saying is true in general and overview, but immediately we have a lot of anger, a lot of fear, a lot of indignation, and these are very real responses, and they don't fit under the cover of an interest. It's a much more a perceived error in the way things are done, or distrust, an upwelling of distrust. And I think one thing about democracy is that there's raw democracy and there's mature democracy. And what you say about interests and understanding, persuading people to participate, is kind of mature democracy. But raw democracy is when people spontaneously get involved. And this is very upsetting to civil discourse, because people, when they're upset, do not rationally describe what they're feeling. They just vent. And it's sort of hard for us to take that in, and yet it is a part of a vigorous democracy.
Well, and Professor Appleby, let me just follow up on that, because some people have been upset about the tone, for example, of the healthcare public forums that happened in August of 2009, for example. And other people get upset about immigration or taxes or whatever it might be. And sometimes I get the feeling that people get upset and say we're having uncivilized discourse when they disagree with the point of view being expressed by the people who are upset. Would you agree with that? And is that true over history?
Well, let's set aside history for a minute, because there's so much that you can pull on. What I think about raw democracy is when people enter into the discourse initially, they aren't very skilled at it. They don't know how to present an argument. So they do vent or shout or do things. That is a part of their education and becoming active participants, though it's hard for people who've been participating for a long time to like it. I certainly didn't like to see those city hall sessions where there was just a shouting, no one could speak. But the other time I thought, look at those people. They're getting into this issue, and probably maybe the first time in their lives that there's been something that has triggered this kind of an active response.
So when you say raw democracy versus mature democracy, I'm not sure what you're saying, because I think of us as living in a mature democracy, and yet what you're describing there with those town hall meetings, it kind of seems more an example of what you were saying earlier of the less evolved kind of involvement.
I think raw democracy is, by that I mean the way of raw vegetables that haven't been cooked. It's just fresh and it's out there and it hasn't been moderated and seasoned. And that's what I mean about it. And it's not that we have a raw democracy. It's that this democracy is like a faucet turner. It's a flow. There are the people who have been in it talking for a long time. People are in there for the first time. And they're all bashing around together. I just think it's a great deal more of a cauldron, by keeping my cooking metaphor, than we allow it if we think of it in terms of serious interest and civilized behavior.
Yeah. Gregory Rodriguez, you wrote an article in the LA Times earlier this year titled Politics, Darker Passions. And in it you said, alienation is the mother's milk of politics, which of course is a play on the phrase from Jess Andrew that money is the mother's milk of politics. What did you mean by that? Alienation is the mother's milk.
I think it's. I mean what all the speakers have already said that we have interest leveraging disdain and distrust and unhappiness and in a sense I would like to pull it back a little bit and my concern is less about the manipulation of people and the leveraging of interest and getting the actual act of democracy as pulling the lever. My interest is in the culture that precedes that level, the culture of the state of civil society that leads to that behavior, that rawness, that we're not actually, we have to think about the extent to which we're speaking to each other before we even get to the actual political issue. We have to think of how much we know, what we understand about any given issue before the interests take them over. And in a sense, and not to plug what I do, but I found it, I'm a useless writer who suddenly got fed up with the fact that the city, this great city of ours, didn't have any places for people to talk who weren't being manipulated by interests. And so I founded a lecture series, and people drew to it, and because it's talking about an issue, not the yay and nay, pro or con, Republican, Democrat. What is the issue at hand? The way you laid out the issue in Pennsylvania, that's fantastic stuff. I mean, this is the idea of actually sitting down and explaining that to Pennsylvanians must be actually fun, but I hope people are doing that at below the level of environmentalism versus, you know, energy interests. So my interest is the extent to which the public is engaged in ideas, several levels preceding the interests.
Coming back to your article, though, I do want to ask you, what did you mean by that?
Oh, yeah. Damn it. He's good.
Nice try.
I what about the article?
Well, what did you mean by that phrase? Alienation is the mother's milk of politics.
I thought I did refer to it. I mean, in that the passions are incited. Our passions are incited either by design, or they are elicited by events, and they get people out to act in their best interest or in their perceived best interest.
So it's not a bad thing. You're just saying that's human
nature.
No,
but it's not a bad thing. But it's certainly it's any time you deal with passions, you're playing with fire. Anytime you're leveraging people's anger or unhappiness, you may be getting them to a ballot box or getting them to a city council meeting, but you're also eliciting energies and emotions that may come back to be harmful to society in other ways. There's all sorts of campaigns that are so nasty that whenever whoever the winner is, sometimes it's just a Pyrrhic victory. Because I had a really fantastic conversation with a longtime Democratic political consultant who will go unnamed, and he said really honestly, he said, look, negative campaigning is nasty. It's awful. It's bad for democracy. But negative campaigning is absolutely necessary to win. So in essence, he says, we have to do things that are bad for democracy in our democracy for it to function.
But let me just add, I worry when people say negative, because the public conflates two different concepts under negative. You can't campaign well if you don't attack, to differentiate. You have to be able to point out how you differ, where you believe the opponent is inadequate, and where you believe you are more adequate. If you can't do that, you can't create an informed electorate. When the public hears negative, you don't know whether it's hearing attack is bad or illegitimate attack, dirty attack, personal attack is bad.
What's the difference between a legitimate attack and an illegitimate one?
I supported this legislation. It was good for the country. You opposed it, and here are the harmful consequences. We shouldn't elect you or reelect you because you have a philosophy that's grounded in a belief that these are the kinds of things we ought to do. We should elect me because I have this alternative. I haven't impugned your integrity. I haven't attacked your intelligence. I've said we differ on an issue, and I make the argument for why my position is better than yours. Legitimate differentiating attack.
Ron, did you want to say something?
Well, I think that I completely agree, and because elections are about choices, and choices mean contrast, and therefore highlighting those contrasts becomes part of is a common component of a campaign. But driving those wedges is not necessarily a component of every campaign. If you're running ahead of your opponent by 20 points and it's 2 days left to the election, chances are you don't have the need to draw that contrast because you're the one who's in favor. I do think it's important to stress that despite all this talk about alienation and emotion and all this negative doom and gloom stuff we've covered over the last 10 minutes, I think it is important to note that politics is 75% relationships. It's 25% everything else. And that's a really important concept for people to grasp, and that politics is about relationships. It's about building relationships with donors, activists, volunteers, fellow elected officials, a kitchen cabinet, supporters, allies, and ultimately with voters as well. And so one of the things which we stress when we train candidates is that it's important for you to build relationships with people in your community, with stakeholders. Regardless of whether or not they necessarily agree with you in the beginning, you need to build relationships with people. I think what happens is that in much of the kind of media coverage of campaigns, the media is very often driven by ratings, and sensationalizes a great deal and focuses on the negative and the doom and gloom and so on and so forth. But really, politics is about addition. It's a war of it's a game of addition, and that means building relationships with people. And I think that gets overlooked with a lot of the conventional wisdom.
But is it also not true? Yes, Professor.
Well, I think
Appleby,
there's a difference between politics and democracy that we should keep in mind. politics is absolutely essential to democracy, but it does tend to draw in experts of one sort or another. Either they're fundraising experts or they are message experts. But democracy is this, the whole society, a large part of the time, is just passive and indifferent. I mean, we know that. There doesn't seem to be. But then when people get electrified by an issue, and it usually is a strong emotion that shocks them into activity, that what I think is interesting is what happens then. As it is, the anger or the fear or whatever gets their attention. But then do they go to Zocalo and learn about the issue so that they learn how to... The important thing from raw to mature is for people to understand how to be effective participants, not just angry participants.
Well, there's something else involved, too. And what Gregory's trying to do, I think, is to break out of what is a human disposition to stay with the like-minded. We live next to people we agree with. We select neighborhoods for that reason. We marry people we agree with. We tend to select our friends based on areas of agreement. We watch a television culture which suggests that when you talk across your own ideology to people on the other side, it's a very unpleasant experience. Our mass media increasingly now are offering us partisan places to go to have our ideology reinforced. We don't have good models of how to engage people we disagree with in a way that might be productive for everyone in the whole.
Did we have those 30, 40, 100 years ago?
I think the separation has been quite obvious for a long time. I mean, for up and all through the 19th century, newspapers were just rampantly partisan. Mm-hmm. The idea of a newspaper that was sort of dull and sober, like the New York Times, was just not in the books at all.
Oh yeah, that's a reservoir of nonpartisanship. The New York Times, okay.
Well,
I think she said dull and sober.
I agree with that. Okay.
It's different from the rags they had in the 19th century. So I think there's always been this divided, not always, but it's predominantly. And it, as Kathleen says, people like to be with a like-minded. They want to read things that reinforce what they believe. And this is a question, I don't have an answer to it. How do you get the ear of people who don't agree with you? People reached me recently about getting a message out about the founding fathers and the religious origins or lack thereof in the founding. And my question is not that we don't have lots of experts who know about the founding era and understand the beliefs and sentiments of the founders, but how do you reach people who aren't interested in a particular view? And I would be very interested in anybody's idea.
Any thoughts about that?
How
reaching people that are engaging people who are disengaged? Is that what
you're
who just disagree?
People in the other
who
camp.
Disagree with you?
How do you reach the other camp? How do you get talking across lines?
I think you have an election, and you're going to have people of different points of view sitting in a legislative chamber somewhere, and they're going to ballot out. And at some point, they're going to have discussions and find some common ground. We have that taking place right now in the California state budget. We have that happening right now between a Republican House, a Democrat Senate, a Democrat president in Washington. These are people of different points of view who would probably not choose to engage one another directly if they were not in elective office, but they are in elective office. They have to make things happen, and now they have to talk to one another.
And it seems like, if you believe the polls, that's what people want.
I certainly think
they want that bipartisanship, even though sometimes leaders of the parties resist it because it's not good for their own
interests. I think there's
an
expectation on the part of voters to get things done, to make things happen, particularly at a time when you have unemployment, which is now at 8.9%, according to the figures released this morning, over 12% in California. When there is stress out there, particularly economic stress, which we see right now, or stress in terms of security, we saw a great deal of things happen post 9/11 when people were very concerned about security. People are under pressure to make things happen because of the economy. There's one other thing that I wanted to respond to from earlier, is that democracy is not just about elections. And this is a hugely important thing right now in countries like Egypt and Tunisia and what I believe is going to happen in Libya. Just because you have elections doesn't mean you have a democracy. They had elections in the West Bank, and Hamas won. And I would argue that you do not have a democracy in the West Bank today, even though you had elections. Because you elected.
But that was a democratic election.
It was a democratic election, but the group that won that election has no interest in adhering to democratic principles. You do not have a democracy there. You had an election there. Big difference. Having a democracy means having freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, protection of property rights so that you can engage in civic discourse and not have to worry about someone coming down and burning your house down or committing acts of violence against you, integrity of an electoral process, and transparency in government. Those are things which are necessary for a democracy, not just an election.
Professor Appleby, you sort of suggested in talking about the newspapers of the 19th century and how there were rags, I think you described them. That I think sometimes when you're in the moment, you tend to think, well, things are worse than they've ever been. But historically, I think you might find something different. Would you agree?
Well, that's true, but I do think now we're in a period where there's a great deal more anger.
More
than the 1940s and 50s and 60s, I would say. Maybe not the 60s towards the end. But even then, I mean, I'm still back to this question of not getting legislators together to talk in a bipartisan way, but how do you get people? How do you get the people who watch Fox to hear what happens on MSNBC? I mean, vice versa. That's what I think is a shame, is that we don't have that discussion, because then I think people would have to start articulating their anger or their indignation.
Kathleen Jameson, is that a laudable goal? Is that what we should have?
I want to interject something that's positive in historical context. We didn't have presidential debates as a routine expectation in politics until the very recent past. In presidential debates, the electorate learns, and you learn about the opposing candidate, that is the candidate you're not going to vote for, as well as the candidate you are. You learn at all educational levels. And we just replicated that finding in the California gubernatorial debates. When the public pays attention to candidate debates that are well moderated, you get exposure to alternative sides and learning takes place. And that's a recent phenomenon, and we ought to encourage more candidate debates.
Right.
And the question should be, how do we encourage more people to pay attention to them?
Of course, just as a lot of people criticize those debate formats for being extremely scripted. And
even with that, we have a reliable finding that says with all the things that you can say that are wrong with them, they are producing positive effects on learning about the side you disagree with.
Gregory, do you agree with what Ron said a moment ago, that elections are the place?
The New York Times is not partisan?
No, not that part. No, that elections are the place where people of different points of view get a chance to interact and hear from each other. Sort of what Professor Jones
That people don't get a chance
that,
to?
No, that is the best place, or at least...
I think it's a brilliant point, I'm almost sort of given up on the partisans. I almost don't care about the partisans. I mean, I'm concerned with the people in the middle, who I think are a larger group than we think, and I think it's the nurturing, the middle nurturing, the people who haven't had haven't been manipulated by either side, is our great hope, and nurturing that they're the hope for civil society and civility. Who haven't already and bought into either side. I think that's what turns that the polls show that people are turned off by. They're turned off by the polarization, and they're turned off by the sort of the monkey dancing on both sides, and frankly the ideological discipline of both sides. It's boring, it's scripted, it's goose stepping, frankly, both sides. And I think that really alienates people who want to be thoughtful. I think people will be more engaged if the process was less scripted, of a big boxing ring. They'd be more engaged if they saw a place for them in it. But right now, you either have to identify with that script or that script. And frankly, any interesting people I know finds both script boring.
Ron Earing?
I cannot disagree more on the argument that there's some type of goose stepping and enforced.
There's no ideological discipline in parties.
I'll tell you, I've been a chairman for 10 years. I've been a state chairman for 4. I was a county chairman for 6. The number of times that Meg Whitman called me and said, "Ron, what does the party want me to talk about this week?" Is zero. The number of times Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Maybe she should have.
The number of times Arnold. Brilliant point. The number of times Arnold Schwarzenegger called me and said, "Ron, which bill should I sign?" or so on, is zero. That just doesn't happen. And the reality is
he was
that,
scolded himself by the party.
Well, hold on. But the reality is that you could see no more broad diversity between Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, our Republican state legislators, and our Republican congressional delegation. Very broad base. There are not all in the same place at the same time. In part because we do live in a pluralistic democracy. We may have 2 major parties, but there are people within those parties who come to politics for different reasons. They have different priorities, different backgrounds, different things that they want to see get done. And so this notion that there are just 2 monolithic blocks that all, march together, that's just not reality.
You make it sound so fascinating. I guess that's why the public is so dying to get involved.
Well,
the public is
that.
Not getting involved for a reason, not because it's an idealized, multifaceted, diverse opinions of both sides. The public is tired of all this, and you're making it sound like there's no problem in the system.
No, that is not what I said. What I said is that there is not this monolithic, each party marching in lockstep. If that were the case, there would have been no reason for Bill Clinton and the New Democrats. Right? Remember when Bill Clinton ran as a New Democrat, different from the old Democrats? There would have been no need for New Labor distinguishing itself from the Labor Party,
the
Labor Party of the past.
Yes.
I'm just using right now today you have diversity between those Democrats who think that Barack Obama has not been far to the left enough. Matt Damon in his interview, I think it was last night, pointing out, here's Matt Damon, who is a huge fan of Barack Obama, saying that repeating someone's joke that he no longer hopes for audacity, right? So there is
diversity.
He was
talking about the financial scandal and the lack of.
I think there's diversity within both camps. Yeah. It's not monolithic.
Yeah. Professor
Ron is like right about that. The camps are just great big umbrellas with all sorts of diverse interests. But what is different is, I can go back to your introductory remarks that you wanted us to have a dinner conversation, interrupt and say anything. That makes for a more or less lively conversation, but no politician would do that. He would say something, and next day that would be out there that he had said something about his mother-in-law and it was against women, whatever. There's no spontaneity in politics
because
of this rapid response in the media.
Yeah, let me challenge that a little bit. Just last week, or maybe it was this week, Jerry Brown went before the budget committee up in Sacramento. I don't remember if it was the Assembly or the Senate, and just took questions, didn't have notes, and just sort of did a very live back and forth, free for all. And, you know, Ron, you mentioned a moment ago that there seems to be some talking across the aisle going on in Sacramento. Do you think that that kind of lack of putting aside the script is part of the road toward engaging people on the other side?
There's a play that plays out in the public view, and then there's also conversations that take place, on an individual level with elected officials and other leaders and so on. But a press release isn't issued every time one of those conversations takes place, and the governor had his smoking tent and so on. People didn't put out a press release every time someone had a conversation there. I don't think Jerry Brown is a smoking tent, probably, you know, but
not for cigars, anyway.
Right? Exactly. But that's such an easy. I'm not going to touch
don't,
that.
Don't. I want to retract it myself.
This is an off the record dinner party, isn't it?
Somebody
pass
this.
Salt.
That's right. but there are those conversations that do take place. But at the end of the day, look, people come to politics for different reasons. And people do have principles. It's contradictory to say we want everyone to get along and compromise, and at the same time you say we want people to stick to principles. Well, which is it? Right. So it's a matter of compromising while maintaining your principles, and then finding those areas where you can agree. And then when you really have to get something done, you know, maybe you go, you know, beyond that. But I think there really is an expectation that people stick to principles. That if you say something, you've got to stick with it.
Well, for the benefit of our radio audience, let me just remind you that you're listening to a forum presented by the California Council for the Humanities. It's Democracy and the Culture of Civic Conversation. I'm Scott Schaefer from KQED. And our guests are Joyce Appleby from UCLA, also Ron Nearing from the California Republican Party, Kathleen Jamison from the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and Gregory Rodriguez, founder and executive director of Socolow Public Square. Let me ask you all to weigh in on this, the notion of, and you alluded to it, Ron, with Libya and Egypt, the internet and Twitter and Facebook, and how is that changing engagement in civic discourse? And just as an aside, you know, Malcolm Gladwell wrote this article a few months ago in The New Yorker before Egypt, and I think the title was "The Revolution Will Not Be Tweeted," and I don't know if he's retracted any of that, but suggesting that that's not civic engagement, that tweeting is not the same thing as going to a town hall meeting. What are any of your thoughts about how technology, social media, are changing what it means to be involved socially and politically?
I'll take a counter point of view on that, and it goes back to the previous conversation on partisanship. And I think Ron's been talking more about the insider and the politicians talking across aisle, and you were trying to talk about citizens talking about the aisle. I'm going to go back to citizens and the extent to which the internet and social media is used. Actually, it can create diversity of opinion, but it can also get people, again, lockstep. And this is, I'm going to talk about what I'm referring to. One thing you didn't say in my bio is I'm a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And I write every week, and I've written every week for 5 years. That's 250 columns. And it's striking the kind of things that one hears and sees on the internet. And the extent, and part of it is the problem of the newspapers that don't no longer moderate. They're so desperate for some sort of engagement on the net. Mm. But the types of people who comment, does anybody look at the, you're laughing because it's ludicrous. And again, it's almost insane.
And
sometimes.
It's anonymous, in a sense.
That's what it allows for. And again, but ultimately the newspaper is responsible, and they're not being responsible. And there's a lot of newspapers that allow this. But the actual conversation that goes on is so, it's striking, and it's offensive. And so I think that the anonymous aspect of the internet has actually created a lot of animosity that, again, I think pushes out the decent middle, the people who want to engage but may not have the vehement opinions that the people who have posted before them have. And if you can't match that vehemence, sometimes you're just better to back out.
I had this experience with an LA Times op-ed. I was horrified, really vulgar.
I get that every week.
Vulgar.
You have to stop reading them, I think.
But I want to go back to this question of the internet and its importance in Egypt and the internet as a form of social communication. It's like the telephone. The telephone is vital if you're trying to get through to someone like the head of state in another country. But it's also what teenagers spend all their time chattering on. So I don't think we should it's a medium, and it was incredibly important in Egypt. And I'm sure he has retracted because it was absurd when everybody was saying how important it was that they could communicate. But that doesn't mean that in 10 years people in Egypt teenagers aren't going to be blathering on, you know, the Twitter and Facebook. It's there to be used for what is necessary at that time. To have it is wonderful.
Is it the same as going to a town hall meeting or organizing a women's group or an environmental group? Or does it matter? I mean, it's quicker, it's easier, it's sort of in keeping with our lack of time that we have in our culture today. But is there anything less meaningful about it or less impactful?
I love the phrase slacktivism. I mean, that doesn't...
slacktivism?
Yeah. I mean, you've heard the phrase?
I haven't.
Well, there you go. Slacktivism, which is, I mean, it takes a very little bit of energy to pretend you're engaged. It is not the level of engagement of going to a meeting. It's better than nothing, and
but
it actually goes farther than a meeting because it may be forwarded, but ultimately...
people tweet and they go to meetings. I don't see that one is the other. I use the telephone. I also have dinner parties. I mean, I don't... I think it's a mistake.
One's not a substitute for the other.
I mean, the meetup capacity of the web helps people organize.
Yeah.
I mean,
you
have the capacity on the web now to find information you could never find before, to read things you could never read before. Thomas.gov gives you the capacity to follow congressional debates and to track and hold people accountable in ways that you couldn't before. The White House, since the Bush era, has been putting up the press conferences and the texts online, which makes it easier to study it than in the past before. That said, you also now are conventionalizing 140 characters as a way to communicate about politics. And I'm worried that that's going to erode our capacity or our disposition to argue. And when you're dealing with substantive issues that require nuance and require careful documentation of the fact base to get to inferences, 140 characters can't do it. It's as if you took the worst of the soundbite culture. And political discourse has gotten shorter and shorter and shorter over time, and now said, let's create an incentive that has the most perverse potential you could to invite simplicity. That worries me. And I think it's how you get dialogues about death panels, because you can reduce that concept to 140 characters, and it makes it very difficult when you're engaging in 140 characters to ever get back out of that to say, here's the concern being expressed. Here's what's actually in the legislation. Here's the response to that. You actually can't put that chain together very well. Mm-hmm. That said, there are other places on the web in which you can and in which people did, and that dialogue took place on the web as well in the fact-checking sites. My plug for factcheck.org.
I want to ask a slightly different question, but does anybody want to weigh in on this before I move
well,
away?
Well, I want to agree with that, but I also want to add that that we shouldn't overblow the concern that the Twitter crisis that has been created here. I can envision that people made a very similar argument about the advent of banners. Well, you can only fit a certain number of characters on that, and that's it. So we're down to just sloganeering, and this is going to destroy democracy, and no one's reading the Federalist Papers and so on. Look,
mission accomplished.
Twitter would not be as popular if tweets were typically 2,000 words. Because nobody has the time for that. People tend to make decisions based upon cues and signals. Right? We're all told, don't judge a book by its cover. Don't judge a book. It's the substance that matters. Right? But you go into any Barnes & Noble bookstore, and you look around, and you find what? Millions of dollars, which completely rational book publishers invested in book covers. So the question is not whether to judge a book by its cover. The reality is that people do. The more important question is, why do people judge a book by its cover? And the reason goes to how people make decisions. Nobody has time to read the book before buying it. No one has time to take the class before signing up for it. No one has the time to do the job before applying for it. People make decisions based upon those cues and signals. And so, when you're trying to engage a broad audience, most of whom are normal and therefore not engaged in politics as much as those of us are, when you're trying to engage normal people, you can't suck up a tremendous amount of their bandwidth in order to try to get a message across. You have to fit it within the bandwidth which they're willing to allocate to that before they get on to more important things like taking care of their kids and getting to work on time and so on.
Well, and that makes an allusion to a point that I want to bring up, which is none of this happens in a vacuum. I mean, politics and civic engagement happens in the broader context of our culture, and education is a big problem in this country. We hear studies about the dropout rate and lack of people, going on to college or community college or even, getting their degrees, whatever. And I'm wondering, what relationship do you see to the crisis in education, public education in particular, to the lack of engagement in our civil discourse today? In other words, do people need to be more educated to have conversations that are more sophisticated about complicated things like taxes or balancing the budget? Or is that just, you know, kind of ivory tower talk?
I tend to agree with Ron that essentially people do break these things down within their context and with the busy things and important things they do every day, and they don't have time to read entire legislation. No, they never did. So no, it shouldn't require a higher level of sophistication.
Do you see the progress we're making here? He agrees with me, and I think slacktivism is a great term. I mean, we were making rapid progress here.
Because the assumption is we started off on opposite sides, which is an odd assumption of yours. Why is that?
You're a columnist for the LA Times. That's enough.
It's worse. It's better than the New York
Times. That's right. There we go. Another agreement. Right.
I think people ought to read across the various newspapers, regardless of what they think about them, because you learn important things that way.
I feel obligated to put in a plug for NPR and PBS. But, education, Professor Appleby,
Of course, it would be wonderful if people knew more. But we do educate an incredible number of people. It is a society. We put a tremendous amount of money into higher education. And, of course, we should put more into public education. In no way am I saying that we shouldn't be more serious about it. But I don't think it's a panacea. I think it's a preparation for life in general. And democracy depends upon the quality of the life of the people in that democracy. So, there is a connection, but I don't see it in quite that direct way. If we got everybody to take my course in American history, I don't know that they would be more engaged in politics.
And there's also an assumption that things have gotten worse. And when you look at what people know about civic knowledge, basic knowledge about public affairs, it hasn't actually changed since the 50s. So there hasn't been a dramatic drop-off, nor has there been a dramatic increase. That said, we have an increasingly large number of people who are college-educated. And as a result, you would have expected the increased level of college education to have pushed some of that up on its own. And secondly, you would have expected the extent to which we have an increased number of people with college education, we would have increased the disposition to engage in such things as watching presidential debates, reading longer forms of communication, et cetera. And we haven't gotten what I would have predicted was the benefit in civic engagement and disposition out of the increased higher education. That's not a social failure. That's a failure of those of us in the academy.
Different topic here, diversity. California is an extremely diverse place. We are now a minority-majority state. No racial or ethnic group has a majority in California, and yet the electorate is still very relatively white in California. About 70% of the voters give or take, in California are white. Is that a problem? And if so, what is the problem? Anybody?
It's a point in history. It's going to change. Again, we've got, back to my Roth democracy and mature democracy, we've got lots of new people coming into an awareness of citizenship. They may have been citizens for a long time. I just think of the UCLA campus, how it's changed in the 30 years that I've been associated with it. I mean, it's the most diverse place in the world. That's going to have an impact on the political participation of those young people when they graduate. So I think it's a question I would predict. I mean, like Kathleen, you probably make predictions and they don't come true and you think it should. But I would predict that 70% would drop, slowly drop, and you would have. I mean, we see that with a more active Hispanic political community. I think we're going to see it with all of these communities.
So not a concern.
But there's another factor that is conflated in the analysis. The younger groups tend to undervote their percent of the population. Older groups tend to overvote their proportion of percent of the population. Your more diverse parts of the population tend to be younger. The question is, how can we get the young more politically engaged in general? And also, then, how do you get these other, you know, representative groups in the population to engage more broadly? And the reason it's potentially of concern is politicians address the voting population, not the population as a whole, for very practical reasons. Right. That's how you get elected. And as a result, if your perspective is thinking from the group most likely to vote, 65-plus, you are far more likely to make promises about Social Security, Medicare, prescription drug benefits without thinking that you need to pay for them in the process. The younger people who are not voting in the process are going to carry the penalty for those kinds of decisions.
I, Gregory. Building on their comments, I think Joyce is right that it is a moment in time and it will build, but I don't think it means we shouldn't make proactive efforts to integrate. I think to integrate the political process and we're not doing it really enough of it. I mean, the extent to which we are engaging growing ethnic groups in the state in the process is really not up where it should be.
Ron Neary.
I think that building on the comments as well, we've covered a number of different things, but I think the starting point is that the world is run by those who show up. It is not people who are registered to vote. It's not citizens in general, broadly defined, who determine the outcome of elections and therefore the direction of our government, but it's people who actually cast ballots. And, you know, I see that on the mechanical side as a party chairman all the time. And, you know, it's called voter targeting. You take a look at who are the people who are most likely to turn out and vote based upon past behavior, and that's who you're going after. You're going after those people who have a demonstrated history of turning out to vote. And I think where the interface becomes with the topic you raised earlier on the issue of education is that there is a correlation between if you're a high school dropout, your likelihood of turning out to vote is significantly diminished. This is a huge issue in our African-American community where you have, you know, where you can see an overlay of breakdown of families, high school dropouts, and not participating in our democracy. I think that is a problem for a number of different reasons. Number one, it means that there are citizens who have rights, but their views are not being heard in our democratic process. That's a big challenge. You know, we're about to go through redistricting, which is where you draw the district lines to make sure that there's an even population in each one of the districts. But it's not based upon who's actually voting or registered to vote. So if you take a look at the number of votes it takes to win a plurality in a Democratic assembly district in L.A., it is a fraction of the number of votes you need to win a Republican assembly district in the Central Valley or in, you know, East San Diego County. And that's because both districts have the same number of people living in them, but the number of people who are actually casting votes is much greater in that Republican area than in the Democratic area. That's a problem. You know, so there, you can see a direct correlation between family, education, and participation in our democracy.
And it affects the political dialogue. So right now, as Washington is making decisions and states are making decisions with scarce resources about how to apportion them, the voices at the table are more likely to be upper middle class wealthy, not poor lower class. And as a result, the danger is that those who are the most vulnerable aren't represented. Their voices aren't heard in those discussions. And that has long-term consequences for the stability and well-being of a democracy.
Particularly since there are young people who are suffering, children and the like, that these cuts that are going to be made. And these are the people that we need to bring into the democracy. We need to bring them in faster, earlier. So we're really saying that the democracy reflects the society. And to the extent that the society is strong and nurturing, the democracy is strong.
Ron, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Many of the Latinos who are engaged in politics in California came of age in the mid-90s around Prop 187, opposition to Prop 187, which was viewed by many as anti-immigrant.
Right.
And that was promoted by Governor Wilson, among others. And your party does have a perception and a reality problem, which is that it's very white, older, upper middle class. How do you, as party chairman, think about that equation and the issues like immigration, for example, where there is a big split within your party about what to do, and yet you have this enormous demographic problem. How do you resolve
it? I think that's a great question. I can't give the answer in 140 characters.
Not asking
so,
you to.
So give me a second to address it. First is that that I think that issues such as Prop 187, Arizona immigration law, and such become very powerful symbols. Regardless of you can argue all day long about the legality of this or that, or whether the federal government's meeting its responsibility to secure that border, or the post 9/11 era means for border security and so on. In terms of, you know, we had a jihadist type of radical who was recently arrested off of Interstate 8, not far from my house, because he had crossed the border from Mexico into the U.S. and jumped into trunk of a car, and some cops saw it, and so on. So you can argue the legality all day long, but the reality is that if a voter is not going to care what we think your income tax or capital gains tax rate should be, if they think that you want to deport their grandmother, or that you don't think that they should be in the country in the first place, and so that I think is the start. We have to recognize that these issues, which which are important. And our party is very clear that we support having our border properly enforced, that I strongly support immigration, our party supports immigration, but we want it to be done through those channels which are established in order to do that. But there's a truth in politics that it's like dating. You can say something and someone else hears something else and you're both right. Right? We have to get past that. So we have to build relationships into all of our communities going forward. Politics is 75% relationships, which means that we have to look for opportunities to build coalitions based on issues. And I'll give you a great example, and then I'll cut off. But in the Central Valley, we had a congressional campaign take place there where the Democrat was named Costa, incumbent Democrat named Costa, and the Republican named Andy Vidak. In a 62% Latino district, Andy Vidak got 49% of the vote against a guy named Costa. Now, I don't know where Vidak is from, probably like Denmark or something. But how is it that an incumbent Democrat was almost defeated in a 62% Latino district by a Republican named Vidak? And the answer is because of the issue of water. Because Andy Vidak built a coalition on that issue of water. So there were a large number of Latinos who were voting for him because Jim Costa was on the wrong place on that particular issue. So there are opportunities for our party to build coalitions and relationships. I think those same issues exist in the African-American community when it comes to school choice and so on. So we have to build coalitions based upon issues. We have to be in the room. We have to be at the NAACP dinner. We have to be at the Cinco de Mayo event. We have to be at the Israel Independence Day event and build those relationships there. I think historically the other team has done a better job of coalition building. We definitely have to be there.
Anybody want to react to Ron, what Ron just said about the Republican Party and minority ethnic voters? Joyce, you're smiling.
No, I'm not. I was just saying, this is civil discourse. I don't think we want to get into discussing political parties and their positions.
Why?
No, I think what he had to say was very interesting.
I completely agree. Very interesting.
What does that mean?
On that note.
Well, but does that mean that we can't? I mean, immigration is a tough issue. Does that mean we can't have?
Is that what he was talking about? Oh, okay.
What are you saying?
He was just talking about immigration?
Well, no, but I was. The question was originally about immigration.
But what was the answer?
Well, I tried to make it more than 140 characters. I was speaking in broad in a number of different right. areas.
I mean, maybe what he's saying is, are you avoiding? Does the party need to sort of get off of immigration altogether if it's going to attract Latino voters?
Well, I don't think the Republican Party is going to become the party that's in favor of illegal immigration. Okay, I mean, I think that's
is
clear.
That what the Democrats are? Do you think?
Well, I think that the Democrats I think the Democrats play to the symbolism a great deal, and the Arizona immigration law, in my view, is not about trying to keep people out of the country. I think Arizona is trying to address an issue which they have, which directly affects their state, and the federal government has completely fallen down on the job in terms of its responsibility to secure that border. And I think the Democrats have done a wonderful job. You talk about driving wedges. Talk about taking the Arizona immigration law and completely using it to energize and get a whole group of people upset to say that those evil Republicans don't want you to be in the country and so on and so forth. I mean, talk about driving wedges. That is a prime example of partisan Democrats using that issue in order to drive a wedge and not in a civil manner whatsoever.
Is that an unfair way to get people involved in the process?
Well, I think it's. I think part of what we're talking about, what is fair and what's not fair. I think that provided an opportunity to drive that wedge, and I think there's a destructive impact to that because I think it moves us further away.
That's precisely from what I was saying at the start.
I think it drives us further.
Leveraging passions is dangerous.
No, I think that doing so drives us further away from having a solution on this immigration issue.
Okay. I want to take some questions, but unless somebody wants to make a
There's
comment.
Always the Catherine. Danger that we talk about voting blocks as if they're ideologically coherent. That is, they hold a single position on an issue.
Right.
The so-called Hispanic vote, when you profile attitudes on the various subcategories of positions related to immigration, there's not a single position that is there. There's real diversity within that community, as reflected in the polls, on how it feels about the various things. How do you protect the border? What are the standards for becoming legal if you came into the country in an undocumented fashion, et cetera? And part of the problem with our discussion of politics is we tend to get up to this level where we assume this group holds this position and that group holds that position and this group holds that position, and we don't honor the differences and the extent to which there's nuance in the differences. And there may be areas of substantive agreement that can be forged out of those differences across the political parties.
Yeah, I
and
totally
it's even
agree.
Simplistic to assume that people vote based entirely candidates on their ethnicity.
I agree with that as well.
That they actually didn't vote for the Costa.
I mean, immigration was not a major factor in the Hispanic vote block. That is, if you define these category of people as Hispanic as opposed to their other 65 demographic characteristics, in their reported Precisely. Selection criteria for Obama versus McCain.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for a very interesting panel. Let me thank all of our guests, Joyce Appleby, Ron Nearing, Kathleen Hall Jamison, and Gregory Rodriguez. How about a hand of applause for all of them?
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.